Dear friends, I am sorry that I cannot be with you in person, but the circumstances appear to call for improvisation. And accordingly, I am speaking to you from a hotel room near Love Field in Dallas, where I have been stuck, but where I have to say the weather is appreciably better than it appears that it is at the moment in Boston. Let me therefore give you from this rather quiet spot the talk that I would have much preferred to deliver from the podium. According to an approximate count, there are 848 subcategories in the classification codes of the Journal of Economic Literature. Of these, five relate to income distribution. Two are classed under microeconomics, D31, personal income, wealth, and their distribution, and D33, factor income distribution. Two are classed under health, education, and welfare, I-14, health and inequality, and I-24, education and inequality. One is classed under labor, J-31, wage level and structure, wage differentials. Under macroeconomics, there is nothing, unless you count I-25, aggregate factor income distribution, which surely means the analysis of factor shares, wages, profits, rent, also known as the functional distribution, and a subject, of course, of classical political economy. Under international economics, there is no reference to inequality at all, nor under development economics. Simon Kuznets, whose immortal 1955 presidential lecture predates, I believe, the JEL classification scheme, is spinning in his grave. So if your interest is in the global macroeconomics of inequality in the personal or household distribution or pay structures considered over time and across continents and countries, you are what is known in the technical literature as shit out of luck, from a formal standpoint. So far as the American Economic Association is concerned, affecting the structure of journals and the assignment of referees, you have nowhere to publish, no place to go. At this point in my text, I have a sentence, "It is therefore nice to be here." Of course, I'm not there, but you know what I mean. There are perhaps two main reasons why the study of economic inequality has been ghettoized in this way. The first is the theory, and the second is the data. From a theoretical standpoint, distribution is the essence of micro, of market relations, and of supply and demand. The discipline exists largely to explain factor returns. If it doesn't explain, and I don't say justify, merely explain, the pay of the worker and the profit of capital, then the rest of what it does would not sustain it. The data element stems from the preference of empirical microeconomists for sample surveys focused on the characteristics of persons or households amenable to econometric estimations and capable of addressing venerable preoccupations with race, gender, age, and education. Against all these advantages, applied economists will sell their souls. They sacrifice control over their research agenda to the designers of surveys. They cannot ask questions about matters not already covered, or at least implicit, in the survey instruments, which very often they did not design and do not control. And by considering that surveys are all there is, economists limit the reach of their research to those places and times where surveys were actually taken. This is a problem because surveys are expensive. The survey record in much of the world is therefore sparse, and where surveys do exist, they were often taken for differing situations by different teams with differing concepts and methods and research agendas. This makes comparative and historical work difficult and the results often inconsistent, even on the most basic issues, such as the definition of income or the nature of the survey unit, especially if the unit is something so malleable and so socially constructed in the final analysis as the household. Wynne Godley correctly insisted that economic models should respect the rules of accounting and the laws of arithmetic. In particular, he urged that the parts should add up and that changes in stocks should be consistent with flows. These maxims are actually not entirely unrelated to the idea, which was advanced by Robert Lucas, that there should be a consistent relationship between micro and macro observations. Let me stand with Lucas on this point. The division of our subject between micro and macroeconomics was a political compromise that originates with the neoclassical synthesis. It exists to permit the coexistence of mortally opposed and inconsistent worldviews within academic economics. It exists basically to accommodate Keynesianism on the one side and the Valrasian system on the other. This compromise cannot be defended. It is a source of intellectual embarrassment as well as of bewilderment for students. Christmas exists, as economists know, only so the more discerning and therefore troubled undergraduates can forget the first semester before moving on to the second. But having made a correct point about the folly of teaching two incompatible subjects, both as received truths within the same discipline, Lucas made the wrong choice. He decreed that micro takes precedence, that the house is built on micro foundations. Godley did not have patience with this. Surely the house is better built on solid concrete and steel pilings, on macro foundations, with micro shingles on the roof. Surely a house like that will be more robust and better able to withstand a storm such as hit Boston yesterday. To switch metaphors, perhaps the tree has macro roots and micro leaves. Ping Zhen showed years ago that if the underlying micro units, the households of the neoclassical imagination, are truly independent in their preferences and their actions, then the law of large numbers precludes fluctuations in aggregate GDP, the business cycle, on the scale that is actually observed. Indeed, if households had independent preferences, as micro theory insists, their actions would cancel each other out, grouped together, and changes in aggregate behavior would be several orders of magnitude smaller than what we actually observe. Animal spirits, herd behavior are therefore indispensable to understanding our world as it actually exists. But if investors, consumers, and governments run in herds, if they are guided by habits and institutions, then it follows immediately also that disaggregation past a certain point is pointless. No additional information is gained by going to the micro level, while time and effort and computational power, when that mattered, are wasted. Cut a salami as fine as you like, each slice is still a slice of salami. You don't learn anything more than what you already knew about how it is made. Let me therefore advance a godly-like proposition about inequality. The first and second moments of a distribution are not actually independent. The study of one should be consistent with the study of the other. The growth of the whole, when it occurs, is usually driven by the differential growth of certain parts, and therefore entails changes in inequality. In general, a small number of macro or mesoeconomic forces, a word that Walt Rostow was quite fond of, should be sufficient to explain changes in both the average level and the dispersion of a distribution. Given sufficient data, a search for macro foundations can proceed. But obviously, for reasons already given, the data cannot come from surveys, nor can they come from tax records, the currently popular exercise. Apart from the occasional virtue of separating capital from labor income, for comparative purposes, tax records are in some ways worse than surveys. Tax records of income are dependent on tax law definitions of income and on the effective enforcement of the tax code. In these matters, only a handful of countries have reliable data, and many have no data at all. And those with good data sometimes change their legal definitions so that the meaning of the top share statistic changes over time. An important example of this occurred in the United States after the Tax Reform Act of 1986, which obliged those in the very highest reach of the income distribution to expand their reported income, to have it recorded as AGI, and then to tax the whole thing at a lower rate. This has since been interpreted by Thomas Piketty and his associates as a major increase in the inequality of income in the United States. It was no such thing. And while tax havens should be suppressed for many reasons, the key one from a research standpoint is that they are data black holes. Is there a substitute? Is there anything else? Actually, there is a plentiful, abundant substitute lying in plain sight. Administrative data on payrolls and employment by industry and sector, as well as on incomes and populations of political jurisdictions at all geographic levels, are ubiquitous. They exist practically everywhere and practically continuously. They are the routine work product of functioning governments for at least a half century and often more. And while the observational frame is necessarily limited, just as a telescope only sees a sliver of the sky, the fractal or self-similar character of income and pay distributions means that often, not always, but often, what you see when you measure inequality across these accounting categories, whether geographic entities or industrial or sector categories, is a faithful simulacrum of the evolution through time of the entire distribution. The core properties of self-similarity and macro foundations have underpinned the research of the University of Texas Inequality Project for several decades. We have demonstrated the capacity of even relatively coarse category schemes to generate inequality measures that effectively track available survey measures of inequality. We have demonstrated the capacity of harmonized industrial classification schemes to generate inequality measures that effectively track the relative levels of inequality across countries, so far as these can be measured by surveys, almost everywhere in the world. We have demonstrated the capacity of what we call the elements of a tile statistic to illustrate the sources, whether geographic entities or industries or sectors, the specific operating forces, if you like, of a rise or decline of inequality through time. This can be done without regression analysis. It's a simple descriptive method that provides a very precise and very detailed picture of what's going on in any given historical situation. Most important, we have demonstrated the capacity of these data sources to fill in the historical record left uncovered by survey instruments. In this way, we have created what is essentially a global data set going back to 1963, covering about 150 countries over this period and almost continuously in most of the cases. There is another advantage: cost and speed. I note that Professor Piketty, along with 100 colleagues, has just released a World Inequality Report with sections on the evolution of global income and 9 chapters giving details on 9, just 9, particular countries and regions. Overall, this work covers 30, just 30 countries from 1990 forward, as against, as I say, 150 in the UTEP datasets from 1963 forward. Among the great findings, we read, most countries saw rising inequalities in the 1980s. Oh, wait, that sentence isn't actually from Piketty in 2018, although something quite similar. At the global level, inequality has risen sharply since 1980, can be found there. The first sentence is from Inequality and Industrial Change, edited by Maureen Berner and James Galbraith, published by Cambridge University Press in 2001, which is 17 years ago, if I calculate correctly. Similarly, for findings of declining inequalities in Latin America after 2000, similarly for the first measure showing declining inequality after the mid-2000s for China, similarly for Russia, survey takers and tax records do get there eventually, in some cases, but my students and I got there first. Jim Tobin was the American Keynesian mainstream macroeconomist who came closest to appreciating that Keynes was above all a monetary theorist. Tobin fought a valiant but losing battle against the rise of monetarism, against rational expectations and structure-free macroeconomic data exercise of the vector autoregressive type. He insisted on the diversity of monetary and financial instruments and the centrality of portfolio theory. He was not a fan of the neutrality of money, and he encouraged, personally, my early work on the House Banking Committee in developing quasi-coercive, or at least effectively annoying, congressional oversight of the Federal Reserve back in the days of Arthur Burns and Paul Volcker. I think that Jim would have appreciated the answer to which our work now points, that financial power, financial policy, and financial dispositions are the driving force, not trade, not technology, not all these old tired lines of inquiry that have preoccupied the economics profession for a quarter century, but financial power, financial policy, and financial dispositions are the driving force behind the rise of inequalities the world around. Here are the key findings of our work. 1, there are global turning points in the path of pay inequality, and as a result, as I'll say later, the other forms of inequality as well. They occur around 1971, around 1980, and around 2000. These correspond in each case to major shifts in the worldwide financial regime, to the breakdown of Bretton Woods in 1971, to the outbreak of the global debt crisis in 1980, and to the return to low interest rates and rising commodity prices that followed the NASDAQ slump and the 9/11 attacks, along with the rise of China in world trade. Inequality as a global trend fell after the first turning point. It rose sharply for two decades after the second, and it stabilized or declined slightly after the third. From these facts, we know that global forces, and not idiosyncratic national forces dependent on the whims of national policymakers in most cases, are mainly driving the movement of inequalities around the world. That's quite simple. If something is happening at the worldwide scale, there must be a common worldwide force behind it. How could there not be? Two, we know also that there are regional patterns corresponding to patterns of economic integration, so that again, the national or the local market unit is not the correct one for which to analyze inequalities. Again, it's not the labor market that's driving this. It is the effect of worldwide financial forces on institutions which have a certain consistency across nations and regions. Three, there is a close correspondence between pay inequality measured across industrial sectors and income inequalities measured across households for most countries for which both types of information exist. If you know the pay inequality measure, you can predict quite accurately the income inequality measure in the same place at the same time. The advantage of this approach of beginning with pay inequality measures is that one can compute many more of them, filling in the global coverage and the historical record. No doubt tax records can supplement this information for top earners, but for broad international comparisons, they aren't available. While the varying coverage of tax filers and definitions of income and of households makes comparative information from the tax files really quite problematic, and we could multiply examples of this as we go along. Four, institutions and political changes and wars and revolutions do affect the timing and abruptness of changes in inequalities, largely dictated by outside pressures. So you have essentially global or at least continental forces affecting broad swaths of the world economy. The response of individual countries can be conditioned by how robust they're, how strong, how resistant their institutions are. Five, we have learned that there are advantages to maintaining relatively low and stable inequalities over time. Countries with more compressed pay and income structures have consistently better unemployment performance than those with higher inequalities, contrary to the mainstream call for labor market flexibility, which is exactly the wrong policy prescription. And there's an obvious reason why this is the case. High inequalities provoke inefficient job search. People leave the bad jobs in hopes of landing the good ones, but there aren't enough good ones to take up all the people who are leaving the bad ones. Further, countries with lower pay inequalities may generally enjoy higher rates of productivity growth over time as their economic climate is more favorable to advanced technologies and less tolerant of low-end businesses that require cheap labor. This is the Scandinavian model, the Rehn model, the model of the LO trade union, a Swedish trade union organization that helped to fuel the growth and rise to prosperity of that country in particular, of all of Scandinavia, over 60 years from the time that the Social Democrats took power in Sweden in the 1930s. We have learned that inequality is rising, and has been rising, at least through 2000, with some stabilization thereafter. And as inequalities rose, sector and geographic data point almost everywhere to the dominant role of finance in rising inequalities. The rising share of income appropriated by the financial sector corresponds closely to the rising relative incomes of financial capitals such as New York, London, Paris, Moscow, or Shanghai. 7. The existence of common global and regional patterns corresponding to major financial developments on the world scale establishes that in the relative scale of things, local labor market phenomena are, for practical purposes, nearly negligible. You can forget about them. Their weight in inequality changes is essentially nil. They are a distraction. If you focus on them as a matter of a priori conviction and ignore the financial dimension of things, you're not going to get anywhere in the study of inequality. There is no race, to be precise, between education and technology that plays a meaningful role in the structure of wages. 8, we have learned that pay inequalities and the degree of industrialization together largely determine the inequalities of income between households as measured by surveys. There are some further factors and forces at work, such as capital incomes and the changing structure of households over time. But if you know the structure of industrial pay and the degree of industrialization, you can calculate basically what the survey-based measures of gross household income inequality would give you for most developed and transitional economies, and for many developing economies as well, to within a few Gini points, which is a very decent approximation. 9, and finally, as for what determines the movement of pay inequalities, what is the vector that transmits the financial forces to most countries of the world, what we have found is that this is predominantly the movement of exchange rates. Usually, in an economy for which, in a world economy for which the dollar is the anchor currency, the exchange rate against the dollar predicts this extremely well. It's a major determinant of the movement of pay inequalities, and which, as I've just said, is a major determinant of the movement of household income inequalities. The line of causation here is therefore unambiguous. It flows from the international capital markets to pay inequalities to household income inequalities, and so strongly confirms that the movement of inequalities is indeed global, macroeconomic, and precisely a Keynesian phenomenon. Macro foundations consistent with meso and micro effects to make Wingodley's spirit happy, and financial forces driving the world economy just as I believe Jim Tobin thought they did. Often, it has to be said, with very harsh effects, but what can you do? One has to look at these matters realistically and draw conclusions that are consistent with the evidence and also with common sense. Well, thank you very much indeed. I would have liked to be here in person, but for the moment, this is the best that we can do.